Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. It's August 7th, 2019. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician with my co-host, Ron Meniza. If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine, you can email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. All right. So we'll check back in with you again, Ron. How's it going?
Oh boy. Well, it's okay. It's okay. I'm still on antibiotics for Lyme disease. Still doing that. Just got a refill on my medication for my hypothyroid situation. So we're still doing that.
Yeah.
And some days I feel really great, and then other days I just fall asleep.
Have you? Are you having more days where you feel really great?
I'm gonna say yes.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So I think we're heading in the right direction. But then the other day, you know, I came home and spin class or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And I came home and I was doing some stuff around the house. I was working on my computer and I just went, oh man, I'm just going to go lay down for a couple of minutes. I woke up 5 hours later.
Yeah.
So that's a little weird still.
So one of the things we did is you finished your course of azithromycin and etovaquone. You had a week's worth of that to scare out the babesiosis. So have you had any, since you took that, have you had any night sweats?
No, I don't believe I've got that.
And the other thing
on.
Is you're taking Inula, which is a preparation of elecampane, which is to scare out that babesiosis as well. In the meantime, and then how are your knees doing?
Knees are hot and cold. Some days they're very, very good. Went for like Saturday. There was absolutely no pain whatsoever.
That's great.
Sunday, my legs felt tired, but I figured, well, it's probably just because I rode my bike. Monday, I was back to square one. My knees hurt, both of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's still coming and going.
Yeah, you know, and right now it's coming. So it's definitely sore right now.
So do you know how long we're going to have to treat you?
Until it's no longer with me.
Until you are well. That is correct. That is how you treat Lyme disease. That's how you treat tick-borne illness. You treat until you are well and not sooner. And this stuff about sometimes you'll hear physicians say if you have a short course of antibiotics and then you're still not well after the short course of antibiotics, it's something else. It's not true. It's simply not true. It's, you know, that Lyme disease, because of the nature of the organism, it hides in your body, it insists, it makes an L form, and it creates biofilm, and it does a lot of different things so that it can stay entrenched in your body, and then it can affect lots of other systems. And our assumption is that you had a predisposition to Hashimoto's thyroiditis and hypothyroidism, and so, you know, the stress of having the Lyme and the Babesia on board probably kicked it into, flipped on your genes. So now that you're expressing it, that's what I'm assuming. I don't know because I also have a suspicion. I am not sure if this is true, but we'll see how things fly. But your thyroid peroxidase antibodies are not super high. They're 30. I mean, people with real Hashimoto's, they have thyroid peroxidase antibodies in the hundreds, even the thousands. Yours are 30. The reference range is 9. That's not a huge amount. It is enough to make you not feel well. When my Hashimoto's antibodies are at their highest, they're at 25. And because I don't eat gluten, mine are down to 8. So I don't have 0, but I have some. And I talked to 2 endocrinologists to decide if I had Hashimoto's or not. And one said, yeah, maybe you have it. And one said, maybe you have it mildly. They were sort of on the fence. Because, of course, you know, you and I don't have antibodies, you know, in the several hundreds nor in the thousands. I am wondering if what's really going on is the Lyme disease jumped into your thyroid and is inflaming it. And so we're seeing thyroid peroxidase antibodies because you don't have any thyroglobulin antibodies, which is great. Thyroglobulin antibodies will show up usually when you have nodules or you have some kind of a you know, an inflammatory or usually some kind of nodule, even if they're benign, you'll get thyroglobulin antibodies. Sometimes you'll see thyroglobulin antibodies and there's no visible nodule, like you'll do an ultrasound and you won't see it. And you don't have any. So thank goodness. Mm-hmm. And it might be a good idea at some point for you to get a thyroid ultrasound just to see what's going on in there. Usually when people have when I diagnose somebody with Hashimoto's, I learn from Dr. Kreitzer. Dr. Kreitzer routinely ultrasounds his patients. And, you know, if somebody first gets diagnosed, you want to have a baseline ultrasound to see what the thyroid is actually doing. So we may have to do that with you at some point. So what I'm not sure of is if we've got your thyroid medicine dialed in. So I'm going to have to order you. At this point, it'll probably be, well, I don't know. I could order it today.
Do I have to get poked again?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. We'll order to see where your thyroid hormones are. And because you're on 100 micrograms of levothyroxine now, we'll see where you're at. I'm guessing you're going to either be normal or you could still be undercorrected. We don't know. So we'll find that out. But also, when you have Hashimoto's thyroiditis, you need to avoid gluten.
Yeah. I've been doing that for 14 years.
Yeah.
14 and a half years.
Just making sure.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
That's it.
And to repeat the reason why, it's because there's a protein on your thyroid that resembles gluten, and thyroid peroxidase attacks it. So if you eat gluten, those antibodies have more protein to go after, and you will make more antibodies. And the antibodies will attack both your thyroid gland and the gluten. So the less gluten you have, the less antibodies you have. The less antibodies you have, the less your thyroid gland gets attacked and the better function you have. So listen to me, people. If you have Hashimoto's thyroiditis or Graves' disease, it's a good idea to be gluten-free. Now, you researched this. You went and looked, and that's the first thing you saw everywhere,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, don't eat gluten. If you have Hashimoto's, don't eat
gluten.
That's
like one of the number ones right there.
Don't eat gluten. Yep. And I have to say, I do see when people get off gluten and they have Hashimoto's, I'll see their, even if they have really high thyroid peroxidase antibodies, I'll see their thyroid peroxidase antibodies cut in half. So if somebody's at 700, they'll go down to 350, which is still high, but it's much better. So, all right. So I thought I'd talk about something fun today, which is...
There's lots of things that are fun.
Oh,
what you
there's
got
lots
in mind?
Of things that are fun. Well, one of the things I was thinking about is being out, how great it is to be outside. And I was thinking of my friend Kurt Beal, who we had on a couple of months ago.
Oh, yeah, I remember
and,
Kurt.
And I was thinking about, I should talk to Kurt about doing some kind of a naturopathic outdoor getaway where we... I'm going to talk to him about this. Is this something that appeals to you? The idea of like, say you had the attention of Kurt and me for a long weekend and you went away to a location and you paid some money and you ate good food and you went on nice hikes and maybe you went swimming in a lake or something like that. And you had naturopathic classes. You know, he had several naturopathic classes in an outdoor setting. Wouldn't that be fun?
It would be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I talked to Kurt about that. I thought that would be it.
Because he's all about being outside.
All about being, like he does research about being outside.
Right.
And
it makes you feel better.
Do you know there is some, now nothing against the Mansfield Community Center. I love the Mansfield Community Center. It's
a
great.
I was just there this morning.
It's a great resource, and it's always there for me. And I love to swim as a counterpoint to riding a bicycle. And so it's always there for me. And, you know, in the wintertime, it's especially there for me because then I get to do my indoor training, thanks to you and to the other teachers at the Mansfield Community Center. But often I won't go there this time of year that, you know, before work, I'll figure out a way to exercise outdoors. And I'll even though it's probably a good day for me to get off the bike sometimes, I get on the bike sometimes just because I want to be outside. And even if I'm not doing intervals, I'll go do a recovery ride. Because yesterday I did a recovery ride so I could look at the flowers.
You can, you can get outside even when it's nasty outside. You can
pictures,
still get outside.
I got pictures of the wildflowers. So here's some great outdoor things that have been happening. So a couple of years ago, unfortunately, Ron and I had a bunch of trees cut down by on the power lines near our house. And we were very sad that the trees went away. But that turned into some good things happening. One of the good things that happened is we have a lot more sun exposure on our house, which lowered our heat bill, which also makes us a better candidate for solar, right? To get solar panels.
Definitely.
So that's one thing that happened that was actually a good thing. More heat shining down in our yard means less ticks, although that didn't work out so well for you anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to still keep the grass short. But a big thing that happened was the trees that they took down were pine trees, so we have very acidic soil. So what likes acidic soil?
The berries.
Berries. Lots of
berries.
Boy,
do we have berries. We have blackberries coming
out of our ears. Last year, we had a variety of berries. We had a few blueberries. We had raspberries. We had black raspberries. And we had blackberries. This year, the blackberries seem to have taken over. But we have ridiculous amounts of blackberries. I mean, I picked more than a pint the other day. And Beth came over, and she also picked more than a pint. It's
and
insane.
There's plenty left.
Plenty more. I know. So
that's more where that came from.
And they're really good. And it was so exciting because I didn't even have to, I didn't plant them. I didn't do anything. They just showed up and it's food. And there's enough for us and there's enough for the birds.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like we're competing with the birds because there's so many of them. It's incredible. I have awful scratch marks all over my legs from collecting them. But what are you going to do?
War wounds.
Oh, Just so you know, there's the town of Mansfield just sent me an emergency message.
Oh, dear.
It's okay. But I'll just state it because it affects us here. Just so you know, there's a gas leak on the UConn campus near the athletic field, and it's being worked on, and you should stay out of the area. So
okay.
if you're on campus and you're nearby, I'm guessing that it's roped off or people are going to redirect you. We were able to get into the parking garage, but... there is, I did just get messages from the town of Mansfield saying that. So, and it came into my text.
So if you're listening live.
Yeah. Oh, get this. I have a new one. This is a message from the town of Mansfield. The hazardous situation at UConn has been resolved and normal operations have resumed.
Wow, that was amazingly quick.
Well, it wasn't quick because I got the notification maybe 10 minutes ago.
Oh, okay.
And now it's resolved. And when
We have quite a town here that can respond that quickly.
Didn't you see when we were driving in, there were some, some...
Yeah, they're replacing all the telephone poles on 275.
Oh. Yeah. But also, when we came around the corner to park in the parking garage, there was police presence and there were people redirecting.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's what that was. So now you know. All right. So that's one thing. So getting outside. And then yesterday when I went on my bike ride... my friend Lori would always say, let's go for a walk and see who's out. And by who's out, she means the plants. So mm-hmm. I saw a lot of really great flowers. So if you're interested in wildflowers now, the things that are out, I think the wild bergamot is it was a big deal like 3 weeks ago. Right now, one of my favorites, the Jerusalem artichokes are up. So the Jerusalem artichokes make a very pretty flower. It looks like a small sunflower or a large yellow daisy, because it is, after all, an Asteraceae. Like Michael Moore, the herbalist, used to say the dern yellow compositae, and he didn't say dern; he used a different word. But anyway, but it's not a compositae anymore. That family is now known as the Asteraceae. But anyway, so Jerusalem artichokes are this lovely plant, and if you put them in your yard, you have to be careful that because it's a commitment, because they grow and then they stay and they multiply. The vegetable that grows, the root that grows underneath them, is edible, and it's really great. If you eat them raw, they taste mildly sweet and nutty, and you can cut them up and put them in a salad. You can make salads out of them. You can pickle them and marinate them. And you can put them into soups and stews and stir fries and stuff. I think they taste better raw because you get those sweet notes. They have inulin in them, so they're really great for regulating your blood sugar, and they're going to be a good thing as a prebiotic, which means that they're going to give the probiotics in your digestive system food to eat. So it's really nice. They do help with blood sugar regulation. They're really, really nice that way. And they make this pretty flower. So I have some nice photos of the Jerusalem artichokes. I also saw Queen Anne's lace. Queen Anne's lace makes me a little bit sad because it likes to grow into the late summer, which says to me it's the late summer. I saw a few chicory plants. Chicory is a very pretty flower. If you're not sure what chicory is, you know what it is. I'll just tell you. It's this flower. It grows sort of, up to your knees, and it has a pale blue. It has a pale blue flower with a lot of a little straight petals on it. So you'll see it by the roadside. You'll see it in fields, and you'll see it growing near the Queen Anne's Lace. So that's out too. That was very pretty. So those are the big things I saw. So it was very, very nice opportunities to see.
And when Fran flowers. goes out and rides her bike, she always takes selfies with flowers.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'll get a text. That way I know that she's okay out in
Look
the road.
What I found. It's a flower.
There she is.
And then I found a little blue flower. I'm not sure if it's wild blue flag, but it might be. I didn't check to see if, because they're growing by the roadside, a lot of them. Not as prolifically as the Queen Anne's Lace and the Jerusalem artichoke, but these cute little, oh my goodness, if you look at blue flag, the first thing that comes up is not the flower. That's not what I found. Iris versicolor. That's not what I found. It's a cute little blue flower, and it's not an iris. But I'll have to figure out what that little blue flower is. It's a little blue Connecticut flower, and I'll let you know what it is next time.
Okay.
All right. So when I figure that out. All right. So speaking of blue flowers, let's talk about the blue zones.
The blue zones. Those are those places where people live forever.
Yeah.
Well, not forever, but for an awfully long time. So like over 100 years, a lot of them.
So there's this guy named Dan Buettner who put together the idea of the blue zones. And there's blue zone projects. And what they're trying to do is figure out... They're trying to figure out how to make blue zones in various places, and also where the blue zones are, what's making them into blue zones. So what a blue zone is, it has an unusually high level of centenarians in an area mm-hmm. who are experiencing good health.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's this blue... there's a blue zones project in Iowa, for example, where they support the governor's Healthy Estate Initiative. And so they have this thing, they have Gallup Healthways, they use the Gallup Healthways Well-Being Index, and there's economic indicators, and they see around there, they have in Iowa, they have the beach cities. And in the beach cities, because of this initiative, they saw a 14% drop in obesity and a decrease in smoking rate of 30% across the entire community in just a couple of years. And, so this is a blue zone project where they're trying to get people to turn into a blue zone. So the state moved from 16th to 9th in the Well-Being Index state rankings and remains
really?
In the top 10 in the latest report from a few years back. And three blue zone project communities in Iowa were among the 15 best complete street policies.
Hey, how about that?
For walkability and bikeability.
Yeah.
And Hermosa Beach was recognized for their complete street policy in 2012.
That's a big DUH.
So complete streets helps with people to live longer.
How about that?
Isn't that great?
I would never have guessed that.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Of
so
course.
That's very
it's kind of
exciting.
Obvious, but you know, if you live healthfully, you will live longer in most cases.
Yes.
I mean, there's obviously there are obviously exceptions to the rule.
So here's so blue zones. It looks like this guy Dan Buettner has sort of quantified and trademarked the stuff related to the blue zone. So he's trademarked something called the Power Nine. So the Power Nine, residents of the blue zones live in different parts of the world, and they have nine commonalities that lead to healthier, longer, happier lives. So here's what they are. They move naturally. In other words, they do exercise, but not necessarily get on their bikes like we do. They just in their daily lives, they're active. They're physically active.
But
so
they transport themselves with their bodies,
right.
not by
yes.
being
they move naturally.
Mobilized by a machine.
Right.
Unless it's a bicycle.
They have purpose in their lives. So they're, you know, when there's something going, so I'm going to read off the list and then we'll go into the different aspects of each thing in the list. So they have purpose in their lives. They downshift, which means they take time to chill out. They rest, they meditate, they worship, they do Tai Chi, they do stuff that's chilling out. They follow the 80% rule. I'm assuming the 80% rule, I'm going to look into it, but I'm assuming the 80% rule is Harahachibu.
Harahachibu? What does that mean?
Only eat until you're 80% full.
Ah.
Don't stuff yourself.
No stuffing.
Yeah, don't eat beyond 80% full.
Stuffing's for the bird, right. Not for you.
Or sure.
Or whatever.
Plant slant, which means they eat a lot of plant-based foods.
Okay.
All right. And wine at 5. They drink wine. Some of them drink wine. They have a little bit of alcohol. Right tribe, which means they have good family associations. They put their loved ones first, and they have a sense of belonging. So if we look into these things, so it's reverse engineering longevity, putting the things, getting these things into your lives that are going to be helpful for you. So here are 5 places in the world that meet the criteria of the blue zones. So first of all, the Barbagia region of Sardinia. So Sardinia that's sort of in Italy, isn't it?
Maybe.
It's the mountainous highlands of inner Sardinia with the world's highest concentration of male centenarians. The next place is Icaria, Greece. It's an Aegean island with one of the world's lowest rates of middle-age mortality and the lowest rates of dementia. The Nicoya Peninsula in Costa Rica, world's lowest rates of middle-age mortality, second highest concentration of male centenarians. The Seventh-day Adventists. I didn't realize this because I knew that Loma Linda, California was one of the blue zones, but I didn't realize it was because there's a bunch of Seventh-day Adventists there. The highest concentration of Seventh-day Adventists is in Loma Linda, California, although there are a bunch in Portland, Oregon, because when the Naturopathic College was at 112th and Market, the Seventh-day Adventist Hospital was around the corner from the Naturopathic College, and we would go there and eat in the cafeteria because they had good vegetarian food. The Seventh-day Adventists are vegetarians. So that's interesting. So obviously you can be a vegetarian and you can be a vegetarian. You can be a carbotarian and eat nothing but sugar and white flour. And that's still technically a vegetarian. But so we hope that when you're Seventh-day Adventist, you're eating a variety of really healthy vegetarian foods. And when you're going to be a vegetarian, you want to eat variety. You want to eat green stuff. You want to eat some beans. You want to eat some nuts and seeds. You want to eat a variety of different vegetables. You want to eat some of Diane Verga's kale. Thank you, Diane Verga.
We had some last night.
We had some last night. It was really good. And the Seventh-day Adventists overall live 10 years longer than their North American counterparts. And then, of course, Okinawa, Japan. Females over 70 are the longest lived population in the world. So Dan Buettner assembled a team of researchers to figure all this stuff out. So let's go one by one for the 9, what do you call it, the 9 aspects that they all experience.
I can tell you where Sardinia is.
Okay, where's Sardinia?
It's in the middle of the Mediterranean. I mean, really, like dead center in the middle of the Mediterranean off of Italian. It's an Italian
That's
place.
What I thought.
But anyway, it's a large Italian island in the Mediterranean Sea. It's nearly 2,000 kilometers of coastline, sandy beaches, and a mountainous interior crossed with hiking trails. Its rugged landscape is dotted with thousands of nuraghi, a mysterious Bronze Age stone ruin shaped like beehives.
Oh!
One of the largest and oldest nuraghi is Su Nuraxi in Barumi. dating back to 1500 BC.
I want to go to Sardinia.
Yeah, we should go check it out. I mean, I can see why they're like a happy place because there's nothing attached to them. They're an island in the middle of the Mediterranean. What nicer place to live?
Yeah.
It must be wonderful there. And it looks beautiful.
It must be gorgeous.
Yeah.
It
looks
really
pretty.
It has nice beaches. I wonder what the weather in Sardinia is right now. What's the temperature? Oh, so they have gorgeous. Oh my goodness, they have gorgeous beaches and stuff.
Yeah, wow. Secluded scenic beaches with caves.
Wow,
cool. Picturesque cliffs with trails and grottos.
I wonder if they
really
have a
cool looking place.
Yeah, and I wonder if they have travel to Sardinia is incredibly safe. In fact, this island is one of the safest places to visit in the Italian kingdom. Sardinia is an island with a variety of landscapes. We should go. Yeah, I see that. The Nuraghi scattered all through, and you're sure to encounter.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, it looks incredibly beautiful. All right, let's go to Sardinia.
It looks really good. Okay, put that on the bucket list.
Yeah, we're going to Sardinia.
Okay.
Yeah, not just to Senegalia. I want to go to Sardinia now. It looks beautiful.
And they have folk traditions there too.
So this is what I was saying earlier. So we're going to go through the nine aspects that the Blue Zone people have in common. So number one was move naturally. The world's longest lived people don't pump iron, run marathons. That's what I was going to say. They don't join gyms.
No.
They don't get on their bicycles like
we
do. They live in environments that constantly nudge them into moving without thinking about it. They grow gardens. They don't have mechanical conveniences. It's like you said, they transport
themselves physically.
Yes.
Is what they do.
And they garden and they work. Yeah. They work outside.
And they work outside and they just basically live a simpler life.
Yes.
And by doing that, you not only get the psychological advantages of that, but you also get the physical advantages.
And they spend a lot of time outside. But that may be a different number. We'll see. They live with purpose. So the Okinawans call it Igikai, and the Nikoyans call it Plan de Vida. And for both, it translates to why I wake up in the morning. And the in Swahili, it's Nia, which is also that I used to teach Nia.
The dance thing that you used to teach.
Yes, neuromuscular integrative action. But Nia in Swahili means with purpose. So it's the same thing. So having a sense of purpose, when you get up in the morning, you know what you're going to do and you know why you are and you don't feel confused about who you are. Because if you know where you're headed for the day and you have an idea of what you're going to do and there's meaning in your life, you're going to be happier. And when you're happier, you're going to live longer. Depression doesn't help you live longer. So this is what Dan Buettner calls downshift. So even people in the Blue Zones experience stress, which leads to chronic inflammation, and stress is associated to every major age-related disease. I tell you, the thing that I treat every day, more than anything else, the number one thing I treat is, guess what?
Stress.
Yes. Yes. Mm. Doesn't matter if you have a cold or allergies or cancer or autoimmune condition or thyroid or doesn't matter. I always ask people, is there anything, if they haven't told me already, is there anything upsetting or stressful that's going on in your life right now? Yeah. I had a guy come in not too long ago. He had a lot of back pain. And then the second time I saw him, he shared with me some of the hard stuff that was going on in his life. In relationships, and that was really a big deal, and he hadn't shared that with me at the first visit. But that's something that happens when you develop relationships as a practitioner. People share stuff with you. They feel safer and safer to share stuff with you, and then you can try to get them moving in directions where they can work on the stress, whatever it is. And it's different for everybody. The stressors are different for everybody, and the solutions are different for everybody. One of the things that I see people do around stress is not own it. They do this with stress and they do this with psychiatric conditions. They do that with, anxiety and depression. They come in, Fran, I feel anxious. Give me something to make it go away. And I'm like, okay.
Why do you feel anxious?
Why do you feel anxious? But the first, before you, but never mind. Yeah, sure. Why do you feel anxious? But that's not even the first thing. The first thing is with any psychiatric condition or any condition at all, the first thing is to welcome it, to accept that you have it. Because if you're anxious and you're fighting against the anxiety, you're just going to become more anxious. If you can, sit there peacefully and go, oh, I'm anxious. Look at that. Then you can do something about it because you've taken the stress out of fighting against it. Because I can't just give you a pill to make your anxiety go away.
No.
All that does, that's suppressing neurotransmitters, but it's not treating the cause. And so, but the first thing is accepting that it even exists. Because people feel shame around having conditions. They feel shame around having anxiety. They have shame around having depression. And so if you can take the shame piece out of it and just come to a place of acceptance, hey, I feel anxious. Hey, I feel depressed. Then you can start working on what do I do about it? And the thing is, these conditions aren't necessarily going to completely go away. And Fran, make it go away. Can't do that. If you're already anxious and we help you with your anxiety now, your anxiety is probably going to come back. So the answer is not to make your anxiety go away. It's to accept that anxiety happens. and sometimes you have to deal with it. And then we help you to have tools so that you can deal with your anxiety. Oh, I'm feeling anxious today. What do I do? So when I'm anxious, what do I like to do? Well, if I'm in Sardinia, I'm going to go to the beach. if I'm
or to the top of a mountain.
If I'm here, I'm going to go pick blackberries, or I'm going to get on my bike, or I'm going to go see which flowers are out, or I'm going to take a nap. Sometimes I even just play a dumb video game.
Yeah.
But
I do that.
And I'm doing, you know, organized activities like yoga and meditation. That works too. I definitely feel better after I do things like that. Or talk to a good friend, or, you know, there's so many things that you can do to deal with the anxiety in the moment. And also accept that you have the anxiety. And if it's a specific situation that needs a solution, if you're too anxious to deal with the situation, you may be in a mind state where you can't even think about the solution. So it's better to step away from it and get yourself calmed down, because the solution will probably come to you.
Mm-hmm.
You're much better equipped to deal with the solution if your stress level has been brought down. So sometimes the best thing you can do about a difficult situation is to step out of it and let yourself calm down so that you can think. So anyway, in the blue zones, they have routines to shed the stress, just like I was talking about. And people in Okinawa take a few minutes each day to remember their ancestors. So they do some ancestor remembrance and prayer. The Seventh-day Adventists pray. The Icarians take a nap. And Sardinians, they do happier.
Yeah, I think I like the Sardinians.
They drink the wine. Yes.
I think I like these Sardinians. This looks like a cool place.
So guess what the 80% rule is? I said, I looked at it and said, oh, 80%. I bet that's Harahachi Bu. So here it is. Guess what the 80% rule is?
What is it?
Harahachi Bu.
Mm.
I was right.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay. There.
There you go.
So the Okinawan 2,500-year-old Confucian mantra said before meals reminds them to stop eating when your stomachs are 80% full.
There you go. There you go.
So the 20% gap between not being hungry and feeling full could be the difference between losing weight or gaining it. People in the blue zones eat their smallest meal in the late afternoon or early evening, and then they don't eat it anymore the rest of the day.
Really?
Yeah. Now, In terms of that,
they must wake up hungry.
Maybe they do, but they're used to it. They might wake up hungry, but you have to realize that everybody's different and what works for everybody. And the problem is that we have a stressful life. We're always on the go. We always have to be somewhere. And we're always worried about money.
Mm.
And that's the reality of our lives
now. Well, it's because we live in the United Stress of America.
Yeah, right. And so that's our reality. We don't have a life that is inherently peaceful. There are things that we do in our lives that bring us more peace.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you and I are living a middle class existence.
Mm.
So there's difficulties with that. And so what that creates is that creates some difficulty in regular meal times. And so, you know, when you have a life with purpose and when your life is set up in a way that is more peaceful, you can be more regular with how your meal times go. And so that's going to, so it creates differences in when you're able to sit down and eat a meal, just because our schedules differ from day to day. So the thing is that, yes, it's true. The Okinawans in general, this is what they do. They have a big meal earlier in the day and they have a light meal later in the day. And then they have a long time period of the day when they don't eat. So if they have a meal in the late afternoon, they're probably doing at least 12 hours of no eating, which is a good thing, because when you spend a significant portion of your day not raising your insulin, you're spending all that time in lower insulin. So you don't have the insulin sitting around causing all the things that insulin does. And, you know, and insulin is not a bad thing, mind you. You would die without, obviously, you would die without insulin. That's why we have, diabetics need to take insulin. Insulin is a traffic director. But if you're in high insulin all the time, one of the things that insulin does is cause growth and storage. That's its job. Its job is to send protein into your muscles. It's to send fat into your fat cells. It's to drive sugar into your cells. And it's to figure out which direction to go. And one of the things it does is it stimulates inflammation, which isn't necessarily a bad thing if you're trying to rebuild tissue. You need some inflammation to rebuild tissue. But if you have chronic inflammation all the time, you're going to gain weight. You're going to have tissue degeneration. You're going to have pain. You're going to have all kinds of stuff like that. So if you spend a significant portion of your day not eating, and by not eating, that doesn't mean not ingesting anything. It means not eating anything that has significant calories and not eating anything that has an insulin impact. So if you consume MCT oil, that's fine. It doesn't impact your insulin. If you consume cinnamon in coffee, that's not necessarily going to affect your insulin. If you drink water with a little bit of lemon in it, that's not going to affect your insulin. So you can have all these things in your whatever period of time that you're not eating. So they may be spending anywhere from 12 to 16 hours not eating. And that's, you know, when we talk about, we talk about intermittent fasting, that's what we're encouraging people to do. Again, you know, I've talked to people about intermittent fasting. Most people in the United States could benefit from it. How do I know this? Because most people in the United States are overweight. If you're if you're overweight, then you have an insulin regulation issue.
Right.
If you're one of the few people who are not overweight, I mean, we're talking 70% of the population of the United States is overweight. A smaller percentage within that percentage is contained the people who are obese. So by overweight,
like
that means
33% or something like
33% of people are not overweight in the United States. So that's very
33% are obese.
Yeah, that's true. And then 30-ish% of people are not overweight.
Mm.
It's a minority.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can expect when you're walking around in a store in the United States, most of the people are going to be overweight. And it doesn't really take much to be overweight, to have a BMI of over 24.9. I mean, I'm there.
Right.
You know, so. So most people in the United States could benefit from not eating for that 12 to 16 hours. And I'm not saying that that works for everybody, because no one diet or no one strategy works for everyone. But the Harahachibu I really like. I think that probably does benefit, that probably could benefit most people, that eating till you're stuffed. One of the things they talk about when you're doing diet modification is to not eat until you're stuffed. But think about that, practicing Harahachibu at all of your meals is probably a good idea. All right, so Harahachibu, that 80% rule, that's number four. So number five is the plant slant. So the plant slant is, and I said, that probably means they have a largely plant-based diet. And guess what? It's all about having a largely plant-based diet. Now, get this. Most centenarians eat a bunch of beans. Not everybody manages to eat beans in our culture because, some people just can't digest them no matter what they do. You know, for me, when I have somebody who's like, but doc, when I eat beans, I get terrible gas. I'm not going to force you to eat them. And there are issues with beans in that they have a starch on them that is difficult to digest. And if for you to be able to eat them, you probably have had to have a history of eating them. And the reason you can eat them, guess what? It's not you digesting it. It's the little buggies that live in your body that's helping you digest them. Now, me, as I'm not a vegetarian, but I play one on TV. No, I'm not a vegetarian, but I tend to be able to eat a lot of plant foods. I do very well with beans. Not everybody's going to, but I eat so much. I eat so much plant matter all the time that my body's used to it. And I've got a probiotic set that allows me to do that. And I also, you know, intentionally consume probiotics I take them in pills, and I also eat fermented vegetables, and I eat what I call hyper organic. Hyper organic is a word I made up. And this is how I define, this is Fran's term, hyper organic. I don't know if anybody else uses this term, but I'm going to describe what I mean by hyper organic. Hyper organic is when you have local growers who are not necessarily certified organic. Organic is a certification that you get from the USDA. And it simply means that you haven't used pesticides on foods within a certain amount of time of sale. So when I say hyper organic, I'm talking about a farm, for example, Tobacco Road or Shunda High Farms or Cobblestone Farms or that nice farm in Willington, Jackie and Spencer. What's Jackie and Spencer's farm's name?
Oh, dear.
That farm in Willington.
I'm drawing a blank.
Okay.
I'm not
all
sure.
Right. So we're, if anybody knows Jackie and Spencer's farm, please call in. Their name is really Jackie and Spencer, is it? That's the couple's name?
I don't know. Maybe.
Somebody told me that. Okay. All right. Because that's really funny because those are my cousins, Jackie and Spencer, and their brother and sister.
Yeah, that is true.
Right.
That's true.
Okay. But anyway, the hyperorganic means that these farms never, ever spray with anything.
Mm-hmm.
They use fish emulsion. They use mineral salts. They use composting. They rotate their crops. And they have incredibly nutritious food. Like, if you can be
right.
assured that if you get this produce, your produce is going to have, you know, orders of magnitude higher nutrients in it than organic food that you buy at the regular supermarket, or and certainly than non-organic food.
And Brian O'Hara says if you grow really healthy vegetables in really, really healthy soil, then you won't have insect problems.
The bugs don't
like unhealthy plants. I mean, they don't like healthy plants. They do like
unhealthy
plants.
They go for weak plants. It's very interesting.
Right.
That's what he says.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
So we, eating hyper-organic, and that's what we try to do. We try to get our produce from those places. This is interesting that most centenarians eat some beans, but not everybody can eat beans. Like I said, if you want to try to eat beans, there's things that I tell my patients if they're like, oh, every time I eat beans, I get gas. There's things you can attempt to do.
That can happen. You gotta rinse the beans.
You have to soak them. Mm-hmm. Even if you get the beans out of a can, if you're getting gas from beans from a can, you're still gonna have to do the stuff you would do to beans that you were starting from dry. So you would soak them overnight. You would put a pinch of baking soda in them. And if you could, you would change the soak water. So if you soak them during the day and you're up and around, you could change the soak water. Because then what you're doing is you're simply, you're soaking out some of those carbohydrates that are going to give you problems, that they're going to just dissolve into the water. And then you throw them away, and baking soda enhances that. So you would do that either to canned beans or to dried beans, whatever you're going to cook. And then when you cook them with carminatives. So carminative herbs are herbs. Mostly they're herbs that have volatile oils in them. So they're going to be just, most culinary herbs have carminative properties. Your cinnamon and oregano and fennel and fenugreek and rosemary and thyme and all, name your culinary herb. If it has volatile oils in it, it's a carminative. And the way carminatives work is actually they're a bit of a counter irritant. They mildly irritate your digestive system to move things along. So they're going to help you. So if you're making gas from something you're eating, the gas is going to move on out a little bit faster. So you cook them with carminative herbs. So if you do the soak thing and then you do the carminative herbs, you also want to do long, slow cooking, because the long, slow cooking, you throw them in a crock pot and you let them sit in the crock pot for several hours, you know, at least 3 or 4. So they get pretty mushy. One of the things that happens there is you're going to break down the starches that are difficult to digest. So if you do the long, slow cooking, you do the soaking, you do the carminatives, and you still get gas, maybe beans are not for you. And that happens sometimes.
I rinse our beans a number of times. The ones that come out of the can, I rinse them because they're very, it's very thick and syrupy in the can.
The thing is, if we're not having trouble with them, then if you don't have that trouble with them, you don't have to be as diligent that way. But a lot of people do. And if no matter what you do, it doesn't work for you, you don't have to eat them. And of course, there's this controversy about, does everybody have to be a vegetarian? Because remember, we have our friend Carl, who is a successful keto carnivore, and it keeps him in remission from inflammatory bowel disease.
Mm-hmm.
So, because the truth is all the nutrients you need, and vegetarians don't want to hear this, I'm so sorry, but all the nutrients you need to live are in animal protein. It's true.
Yeah.
If it's an animal, it's going to have all the nutrients you need to live. That's the way it is. And I'm not saying, and I know that's a heart that's like blasphemy to a vegetarian, but I'm not saying if you're a vegetarian and you're happy and healthy, you should be a vegetarian. Also, me, Fran, I'm not a vegetarian, but I eat a lot of plant foods and I can't eat a lot of animal protein. So I eat mostly plant-based foods. So I'm not going to be going keto carnivore anytime soon. If I figure out I have an inflammatory disease where I have to be closer to paleo, I might do that. But, you know, I do very well eating lots of plants, and I do very well eating some days no animal protein at all. But I found that since I started exercising heavily, I need some animal protein, and I crave it, and I don't crave it every day. And I do find that when I eat heavy vegetable sources of protein, like nuts and seeds or like tempeh or beans, I do very well. Not everybody's going to be that way, because guess what? Everybody's different. But anyway, in blue zones, most centenarians, beans are the cornerstone of most centenarian diets. Meat, which is mostly pork, is eaten on average only 5 times a month. And serving size are 3 to 4 ounces, about the size of a deck of cards. So in the areas, in the blue zones, the preferred source of meat is pigs.
Really?
Yeah, because they don't take up a lot of space. They're easy to raise, and you can feed them a lot of different things.
They're very economical to raise.
These people are this way because it's practical. So if they're eating pigs, there's something practical about the pigs. Pigs eat a lot of different things. They're omnivores. So you can feed them a lot of different things, and they don't take up a lot of space, and they taste good. Poor pigs. They're also cute. It's unfortunate. All right. Wine at 5. People in all the blue zones, except for the Seventh-day Adventists, they don't drink alcohol. But all the rest of them drink alcohol moderately and regularly. Moderate drinkers outlive non-drinkers. The trick is to drink 1 or 2 glasses a day. But the best is apparently Sardinian Cannonau wine. So I want some of that. And also you drink it with friends and with food, and you can't save up and have all your drinks on the weekend. Binge drinking is bad for you, obviously, because you're going to overwhelm your liver. But if you have a little every day, that's different. Maybe I should have a little more wine. The only thing with me drinking wine is I don't feel that great when I drink it. So
yeah, and then if we crack a bottle open,
you
don't drink very much of it. No, I don't. The bottle goes to waste.
All but 5 of the 263 centenarians we interviewed belong to some faith-based community. So most centenarians belong to a faith-based community. And it doesn't matter which one. It's whatever one you like or want to go to or whatever. And that if you attend faith-based services 4 times a month, it'll add 4 to 14 years to your life expectancy. Being part of a faith-based group is good for you, Ken Ferguson. It increases your life expectancy. Isn't that nice?
You just shouted out to Ken.
I did. He would like this.
He would.
That you know, for being part of a faith-based community extends your life. So it can be whatever you want to be part of. It can be, you know, part of a yoga community. It can be a spiritual, you know, a meditation group. It can be, you know, any of your classic denominations, whatever Judaism you want, whatever Christianity you want, whatever Islam you want. It doesn't matter. Whichever one you like and are happy at. All right.
Right.
Put your loved ones first. There's a shocker.
Yeah.
They put their families first. That means that they keep aging parents and grandparents nearby or in the home, and it lowers disease rates and mortality rates in children in the home when they have the older relatives around. They commit to a life partner, which means that. And so if you have a life partner, it can add up to 3 years of life expectancy, and we see why, because, you know, what if you didn't have me around to figure out your Lyme disease and Hashimoto's and babesiosis?
I would be a wreck.
I wonder, and your gluten.
Yeah, all those things.
I wonder how many. So that's adds up to 3 years of life expectancy. Wonder how many.
Thank you, dear.
I wonder how many years of life expectancy I added to you. I probably skewed it in the other direction.
Well, you probably took care of a possible oncoming colon cancer. Problem,
right,
which could arise from having irritable bowel.
Yeah,
right.
From or inflammatory bowel, or
right?
Eating gluten, having celiac disease.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that was a good one.
So you're probably going to be a centenarian because of me.
Okay.
And also stuff that I learned from other people. I mean, I didn't
you think
do this in a
you
vacuum.
Think I'm going to live to 100 years of age?
I have no idea. But you're more
I don't
likely
get hit
to
by a bus
because
yeah.
because you're being overseen by a naturopath in the home. You have a better shot at it.
There's always a doctor in the house.
That's right. Then there's always this right tribe. The world's longest lived people chose or were born into social circles that support healthy behaviors. So when you hang out with people who are into being healthy, you're going to be healthier. Big D-U-H. So the Okinawans create moais, which are groups of five friends that commit to each other for life. And in the Framingham study shows that smoking, obesity, happiness, and even loneliness are contagious. So the social networks of long-lived people have favorably shaped health behavior. So having good social networks makes you live longer. So having friends, having people you like to hang out with.
Having community,
yeah. All that stuff.
Community is good. Yeah. It's a good thing. It is. And, you know, my sister and I were talking about that yesterday because she was stopped by for a visit and we were chatting and she had gone to a gathering out in this area with mutual friends.
Yep.
And she said, boy, everybody knows everybody out here.
Yeah.
We do.
We do.
We know a lot of people out here.
It's fun to sit in the co-op and just watch people come from at the checkout and go, I know her, and say hello to everybody, chat, you know. Going to the co-op, it's like you have to go with energy because you don't know who you're going to see there. Yeah.
But that's not a terrible thing.
No, it's not a terrible thing. It's the same at the farmer's market, too.
Yeah, it's good. It's good stuff. Good community.
We had a really nice ride committee meeting the other night. It was really efficient. It was really positive. It ended in less than an hour.
It was quick.
And it was so short that people felt like they had to schmooze after. It was so cute. People didn't want to leave because they were like, they didn't feel like they got their social time. So people were schmoozing after and it wound up taking just over an hour because of the schmoozing that needed to happen.
Right.
And people were just happily schmoozing about various things. It was great. Yeah. So we have social circle too. All right. So Blue Zone things. If you want to benefit from Blue Zone health things. And Blue Zones, once again, are places in the world where they live where there's a high concentration of centenarians. And Ron and I are going to Sardinia. All right. So so the nine things are: you move naturally, you have regular movement in your everyday life, you live with purpose, you downshift, which means that you take naps or you relax or you meditate or do yoga or you go in nature, all those things, that stress-reducing activities. You'd follow the 80% rule, the Harahachibu, where you eat only until you're 80% full. The plant slant, you eat a lot of beans if you can, otherwise eat a lot of produce. Again, if you can, most people can. If there's a special reason you can't, obviously you don't, but otherwise. Mm-hmm. If you're not eating enough plant-based foods and you don't feel well, maybe you need to add more. Drink some wine.
Mm-hmm.
Or drink a little bit of alcohol in moderation, 1 to 2 drinks a day.
Hmm.
Don't binge.
We're going to have to work on that.
Be in the right tribe. Meaning that hang out with people who, what was the right tribe? The right tribe was number, here, let me see the right tribe. That's just, the right tribe is a faith-based community. See if there's a faith-based community that appeals to you if you want. Put your loved ones first and hang out with a group that supports good health.
There you go.
So these are all good things to live by. All right. So you've been listening to 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. And this has been Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. I'm Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician with my co-host Ron Meniza. You can also email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores.